From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to have one of the most delightful humans I know on the show, the one and only Mandy Moore. So Mandy is currently starring on the monster hit show This Is Us, which I'm sure you're all watching because everyone in the world is, but she's also been acting for the majority of her adult life in movies like The Princess Diaries, A Walk to Remember, and as the voice of Rapunzel in the Disney film Tangled. But, as I'm sure you remember, before she started focusing on her career as an actress, Mandy was a singer and a pop star and signed a record deal when she was a freshman in high school. In the late 90s, she toured with NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys, promoting her debut hit single, Candy, and working on her first album, which sold over a million copies. Since then, she's been steadily acting in film and TV and has released 6 albums. What I find particularly interesting is the way she's been able to successfully move back and forth between the music and acting industries, which certainly wasn't a common phenomenon when she first started out. With no further ado, this is Mandy Moore on Second Life. You multi-hyphenate singer, songwriter, actress, thank you for coming on
Second
Life.
Thank you for
having me. I'm really excited for you to be
here.
I am
too. You know that.
Okay, so on this podcast, as in life, we like to start in the beginning. So let's talk about your origin story, which is your singing career.
Yes.
Okay, so you were really aggressively young when you started.
Aggressively, yeah.
How did you know you wanted to be in the music world?
I didn't, per se. I didn't. I grew up...
Because you were a child.
I was a kid being forced against my own will. I was a big theater kid. I grew up outside of Orlando, Florida, and I just was like driven from and focused at a really young age. My ultimate goal was to be on Broadway.
Really?
Yeah. And I did everything, like every play possible. I sang in school. And it took, this is a very weird, convoluted story that I've told a few times, but I also loved singing the national anthem, like at every sporting event. It could be like a roller hockey team or an arena football team. I got in once singing for the Orlando Magic, and I think whoever booked that then just like roped me in to sing for every other sports team that happened to play in the arena.
Well, let's be honest. It's a really difficult song to sing.
It's the most difficult.
If you can sing it, that already puts you in, like that's a small bucket, so.
I think I was just like a semi-cute, like awkward 12-year-old that like wore an American flag hair bow. And so, like, the cute factor maybe, like, sort of, like, pushed me over the edge.
It's still a hard song to sing.
I agree, and I would never do it now. I'm terrified to do it now. People have asked me, and I'm like, nope, those days are behind me. Okay, I've retired the national anthem. But
so when did you start singing it?
When I was, like, 12, okay. I went to an Orlando Magic game, and I saw a little girl, like, my age singing it, and I had no idea that that was a possibility. And so I had my parents, like, record me on the camcorder, and we sent in a tape.
Like a VHS tape?
A VHS tape. And my mom dropped it off with like fresh baked cookies, which I also think sort of put me over the edge.
Yes, 100%. Baked goods are always good when trying to worm your way
into someone's heart.
A career. Yes. Right.
Duh. It's the reason that I'm here today, those cookies. Mom. And I essentially sang for all of these other sports teams. And I remember I was at singing for, I want to say they were the Predators or the Lightning or something. It was the ice hockey team. And I walked out with my little pitch pipe and I sang and I was like walking off on the little carpet to the penalty box where my dad was sitting waiting for me. And these two gentlemen like beckoned me over and said, "We really like your voice. Have you ever thought about recording a demo in a recording studio? We have original songs and we think that you would be this amazing recording artist," which, by the way, was a total lie because I wasn't that great. And I was like, I was maybe 13 or 14 at this point. And my parents were like, sure, if you, we were just going into like summer before starting high school.
Got it.
So I was 14. And they're like, if you want to spend some of your money that like I had made doing local commercials and stuff, like you can spend like a week in the studio. And so that's what I did with these random strangers. I went into a recording studio and started recording their original songs that they had written when a man who was delivering boxes for FedEx heard me sing. And he had like a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend who was the head of urban A&R, as they called it, at Epic Records in New York. And this guy had signed the Backstreet Boys at Jive Records. And then he had just moved to Sony, to Epic. And he heard something that he must have liked in this demo. And he flew down to Orlando and I auditioned for him.
So wait, the FedEx man?
The FedEx man helped facilitate it. Like he had this.
No.
Yes. Because he like knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who knew this guy. So he managed to like get it in this guy's hands somehow. And he was compensated for it. Like, you know, they gave him like a finder's fee or something because I ended up signing a record deal with Epic Records and I was 15 years old.
Oh, my God.
It's so insane.
I mean, that's so, like, I was worried about, like, cheerleading practice.
Sure. As was I, by the way.
Like, and, like, if I could get my homework done in time.
Yeah.
How did you deal with, like, the added pressure of also putting together an album? And did you know what you wanted it to sound like?
No.
Did you have...
I had no clue. I mean,
like,
that's...
whose career did you like? Did you want to emulate someone?
Bette Midler.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Very commercial.
Very commercial, I know, for like a 15-year-old. Like,
classic pop star.
That's who's on my pedestal, not Madonna. And this was like at the time that Britney and Christina and everybody was coming up. So I quickly realized like, oh, okay, I guess I'm my record label's like answer to that. I'm that version of those people, of those contemporaries. But at 15, like I didn't know what kind of music I liked. So I didn't know what kind of music I wanted to sing. I was just grateful for the opportunity to sing songs that were like for me. They were mine. Like nobody else had sung them before. And so I got to sort of put my own stamp on that, whatever that meant. but like at 15, you don't know. I'd maybe like French kissed a boy before, but like I didn't know anything that I was singing about. I had no experience. I had no real point of reference. And I remember
you had an imagination.
I had an imagination, but I remember the first time I heard Candy, and I was like, I don't even know what this means. How can you miss someone like Candy? That makes no sense whatsoever. Like grammatically, in no world does this like measure up. And I was lucky to be in the position where nobody told me like what to wear or how to answer questions, but they did sort of tell you what you were gonna sing. It was like, this was presented to me as like, this is the single. Whether you like it or not, like we have decided as a conglomerate, like here at this record label, this is your single and this is how it's gonna be.
And so, how did you feel about that?
I think I struggled with it initially just because I didn't quite know who I was. I was like in the middle of becoming a young adult. And
right.
But again, I was always grateful for the opportunity. I was like, how do I find a way in there? How do I make this work? How do I find a way to essentially like feel settled with this? Because in a way, I sort of became this traveling saleswoman with my wares of toting this like one song around and five or four male backup dancers. And just like trying to sell it, I guess,
okay,
as best I could.
So were you able to make it stylistically what you wanted it to be? Or was it really like in that very beginning, was it like, this is the whole package?
This is the whole package.
Okay.
Yeah. It just sort of was, you could have slotted anybody in there. Any woman or man. And maybe it's similar. I don't know the music business enough like nowadays to sort of understand that. But I felt like in those days it was like Max Martin or X producer has this handful of songs. And like, do you want this one? Do you want like oatmeal, chocolate chip? That was as much input as you had in a sense. Which, again, I was very grateful for the opportunity. But it didn't really give you any leeway into like individuality.
So... But then at the same time, they let you dress the way you wanted to dress. And I assume, like, when you started making videos, did you have input on that?
Not really.
Okay, so
no.
There were pockets of you.
Yes.
But It was like, okay, so you're going to wear an arm band and different hairstyles, and you're going to do this choreography, and this is how, and you're going to drive this green Volkswagen. Beetle.
But again, when you're a teenager, all of that seems so cool. I was like,
P.S., did you even have your driver's license?
I did not. P.S., I did not. I had my learner's permit. So they had to pull the car. They had to tow it like they do in movies, which I thought was phenomenal. It was so much more exciting than actually driving. But yeah, it's like I felt authentic because I was still able to be myself in the midst of like this slightly manufactured situation. And I tried to make it work as best I could. But I think as I've gotten older, it's like I started slowly but surely trying to like box my way out.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So you went on tour really early too with both NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
What was that like? And how old were you? And what was that like?
15.
Holy
so
cow.
I went from being here in Los Angeles. I made the Candy music video, and then I got on a plane the next morning and flew to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and started the NSYNC tour. And it was like a summer amphitheater tour. And we started out initially like in a 15-passenger van with like a trailer towed behind us. And we were performing on the like second stage that was right as you like got your ticket like ripped and you walked in. We were right there. So whether you wanted to see us or not. And then eventually as the tour went on, we got moved to the main stage and opened up for them there. So
did you
–
what sort of prep did you have for that?
Oh, my gosh.
Like did you know – I mean like first of all, I also want to go back like – making a music video, did you have any idea what you were doing?
No. And I watch it now and I'm like, who is that little girl who was so self-assured? Like, not a fear in the world. I just, and I think the same thing when I watch, well, I don't watch performances of myself, but I remember that sense of fearlessness being on stage, like touring with NSYNC or with the Backstreet Boys, which happened later that fall. And walking onto, I remember the Backstreet Boys had a stage in the round during that tour. And so the lights would all be off. And I remember distinctly like looking around in these giant arenas with like 20,000 glow sticks. And my pulse wasn't even elevated. I was so confident. Now I would throw up. Like I would be so nervous. I would be an anxious, sweaty mess. I couldn't, like I'd need a beta block. I'd need a couple beta blockers. Like there's no way. But as a kid, you don't know that the stakes are so high, and so you just like I threw myself into making that music video, and I had no idea what I was doing. And it was just
like, did they give you acting lessons? Like, did you have a choreographer that you worked with? So
because I'm a terrible dancer,
really.
If you watch that Candy music video, I had no idea what I was doing. I'm so like, I'm just going through puberty, so I'm like just this long little skinny string bean with like
you're
all
very
arms
lanky
and legs, and I don't know how to dance, and I have no rhythm. I still don't. And I think they realized after that music video, like, you know what? We'll just let you sing.
You're so committed.
We'll have dancers behind you to distract people. But yeah, I was committed.
So you go to tour.
Yes.
But was it scary? Was it cool? Were you on your own?
I was on my own. I was with my parents. I had mom or dad, like one or the other, always traveling with me, which I feel like was a total lifesaver. But I was 15 and like I had four sweet male backup dancers, but they were all in their like mid-20s. They don't want to hang out with a kid. So it was a pretty isolating life in that sense, like for a good couple of years, for sure.
I was going to say, what was your life like? Was it just touring?
It was touring, and I was homeschooled, and I was doing like extended studies. So when I wasn't like performing or like going and meeting people at radio stations and shaking hands and kissing babies and doing, again, being like the traveling salesman, I was doing school, like in a workbook in the back of the van, just trying to carve out time to finish that. And I ended up finishing school early. But it was, I would still see my friends occasionally, but it was a pretty crazy time. Like nobody quite knew what I was doing until they saw a music video on TRL. And then that kind of changed everything.
How did your peers react? Was that hard? Because
yeah, I remember going back to my homecoming dance when I was 16, like the next year, like a year after I had left school, and people were really, my friends were great, but like other people at school were jealous and uncomfortable, and they made me feel really awkward and out of place that night, and that was terrible. I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to do this again. Like, I'll see my friends outside of the school environment.
Like, hard pass on homecoming.
Hard pass on homecoming, yeah.
So what part of this sort of like early career in the music world did you like the most? And also, what did you dislike the most?
I think that I liked the touring, the adrenaline, the rush of performing live. Like, nothing duplicates that. You don't feel that way when you're on a set. It's just there's no way to sort of compare with that rush. So that was always my favorite and always sort of what drove me, because my least favorite part was probably, I would say, the rehearsals, like, because I'm so not naturally a dancer. And I think for a while, like, that music video and then shortly thereafter for that first, like, part of that NSYNC tour, I was just sort of being drilled to, like, try and dance because that's what Britney was doing and Christina was doing. And they are just natural performers and I am not. Very shortly thereafter, they realized, like, oh, this is not going to happen, and they kind of let it be. But that was – I have, like, bad memories of being here at SIR, which is, like, a big performance rehearsal space for musicians, and, like, just hearing Candy over and over and over again and, like, a couple other songs on that first record and trying to dance and just – having no rhythm and not liking what I saw in the mirror and not understanding my body, and all of it was just awful. Yeah.
Okay, so, but that first album sold over a million copies.
Somehow.
What was it like dealing with that level of success at that age? Did you understand how amazing that was? Or was it just like,
you're
in the middle of all of it and it's just another thing?
I think a little bit of both. It was like equal parts being flabbergasted by it, but also just like keeping my head down and plowing forward and moving on to the next thing, which I think has sort of been my key in life. It's like my go-to. It's my fallback move. Like, okay, when times are tough, I'm just going to like dig in, keep my head down and keep moving forward. So I feel like that's just like my natural – where I naturally sort of exist.
Okay. Yeah. So I couldn't help but wonder while I was looking at some of these music videos, is that in part where you caught sort of the acting bug, or was that something that had been a part of your life forever as well? Because between the first album and The Princess Diaries,
yes,
is only a couple of years.
Yeah, it's like a year. I was 16, I think, when I made The Princess Diaries.
How did you move over into doing that? Because also, like, nowadays, everyone's like, I have an album and I have a Vegas show and I'm on TV and I'm in movies and it's totally cool and everyone's down.
Yeah.
That was not a thing.
No, it wasn't. And in fact, I remember it was an uphill battle. Not only just like when I was starting out and auditioning, but like once I did do The Princess Diaries and then A Walk to Remember, it was like the most asked question of like transitioning from music to acting. Like, how has that been? Do you think people are able to escape who you are in your music videos and watch you on screen? And it was.
Meanwhile, you're like, I've only had a career for 2 years, people.
I'm still a child. Like, I can't even vote. it's. And you're right. Nowadays, it's like it's so expected to kind of be that multi-hyphenate and do a million
360
things.
360 brand.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't like that in the late 90s, early 2000s. But I think because I was a theater kid and I always, always wanted to be like, again, I loved Bette Midler. And I was like, she does Broadway and TV and movies and makes records. And she's her own person. And she seems like a like she's got a personal life and all of these things that I like could acknowledge as a kid and I really admired. So because I found some success in the music industry, it really did open the door to like at least trying my hand at like going in and meeting with people and reading scripts. And The Princess Diaries was it was not like the first thing I had auditioned for. I had like had a couple of meetings around town and things that just didn't come to fruition.
But this was something that I personally wanted.
I drove that ship.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I remember my manager at the time, who was my manager for years, was from the music industry. So when we first started working together, I was like, I have ambitions to be an actor as well. And he was like, I know nothing about that world. But I was like, well, just follow me. Because that's
we're going to figure it out.
We're going to figure it out together. And we did. But I always had designs on the acting world. It's funny that that was what sort of started to eclipse the music, because the music was what I was most passionate about. And I thought, like, oh, cool, I'll get to do a little bit of both if possible. And then the acting, that ball just started rolling. And
so when you show up on your first movie set and are acting in front of the camera for the first time, did you, like, what sort of prep did you do beforehand? Like, did you know how to hit a mark? Did you know your angles? Did you know motivation? Like,
I feel like I still don't know any of that stuff.
Oh, man.
Like,
how did you prep for that? Again, like, maybe in some ways you're just like, I'm 16, this is happening.
Yeah, kind of. I think that fearlessness sort of, like, glides you through uncomfortable situations. I must have done some sort of prep, and you kind of just learn as you go along. You kind of just expect that, like, people are going to recognize that this is my first real job. And I had done commercials and stuff, but nothing obviously of that caliber. You're doing, like, a Disney film with Julie Andrews and Gary Marshall's directing it. And I just relied on, like, the graciousness of people who had been in my position before to sort of point out, like, show me the ropes.
Really?
Yeah. And
you learned on the job.
I learned on the job. I haven't seen that movie since the premiere in like 2000. I'm pretty sure that I'm terrible in it because I had to have been because I didn't know what I was doing. But even I remember in A Walk to Remember, which was the next film that I did, I still, like, I really hadn't learned too much. I hadn't retained it because I remember Shane West, who played, like, my love interest in the movie, had to literally position me and, like, to make sure that I was hitting my mark or remind me, like, don't look down. I didn't know what I was doing. It took me a while. I feel like just now on this TV show am I finally starting to understand lenses and lights and what everybody sort of does, because I'm like, oh, great. Like, this is our third year. I think I finally understand my job. It's terrible.
No, but that's also so great, though, too. But wait, why haven't you watched The Princess Diaries?
I find it really hard to watch myself, even though I'm a tiny sliver. Yeah. Even though I'm just a tiny sliver of that movie, I'm sure it's I wonder how it's aged. I'm sure it's adorable. And Anne Hathaway's amazing. And yeah.
I feel like you need to go and watch it and report back. I think that would be really, really amazing.
That is my form of torture, Hillary. Watching myself at 16, like smushing ice cream on Anne Hathaway. Oh, God. Singing on the beach, like, oh, it gives me chills.
So how did you go about picking roles then, too? Because also on a side note, Saved was one of, like, my early favorites.
Thanks,
and not
too.
Just because your name was Hillary. When my husband and I were talking about Saved last night, and he actually said, he's like, you have to tell Mandy. It was such an interesting choice. He recognized at that time, he's like,
I appreciate
this
that.
Is cool that she's, like, playing the sort of against type with her music career. And so my question is, were you purposefully trying to make some of those choices?
Absolutely.
Or were you just, like, whatever cool thing came, you would go with that?
I think it was a little bit of both of,
some
like,
strategy.
What hit you creatively, but definitely there was a strategic element there, for sure. And it wasn't just, like, me making the—I mean, obviously, as an actor, and you're in control of, like, all the final decisions, but I felt really lucky to have, like, a very qualified, like, team. I had a great agent and manager who all let me be me, but sort of we were all very much on the same page from the jump. I remember reading that script and then meeting with Michael Stipe, oddly, who was one of the producers, and it was because Anne Hathaway, fun fact, had dropped out. She was supposed to play Hillary Faye, and she dropped out to do something else, and I just, like, weaseled my way in there and decided to, like, have a blonde mullet. That was not required, but I made a very weird creative choice. It was risky, but yeah, I think I was openly looking for ways to expand my horizons, but, like, do things that people weren't necessarily expecting of me. Because it's fun. Like, it was not only a challenge creatively, but, like, I sort of got off on the fact that, like, people weren't expecting some of those choices.
Okay. So you had a very clear idea about brand.
Yeah.
And path.
Yes.
That's really interesting.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, you were a baby. And to have that sort of perspective on where you wanted to go, what you wanted to do, how you wanted to achieve that, that's really impressive because, you know, I don't think – I've been much more fly by the seat of my pants in a lot of ways.
And I have too. But it's funny. I think growing up and coming of age and starting a career at a time where people are trying to label you and box you in, you very quickly have to identify like, well, who am I and what do I bring to the table and what sets me apart from other people? And I think I knew at like 15 or 16, like, I know who I am. I know what I feel comfortable doing, what I don't feel comfortable doing. And I hope that I'm always in a position to like voice that and that people allow me to be myself. And I have been so far.
So how did you go back and forth between music and acting? And then also, at what point did you start taking more control over the music piece of it? Because it seems like the acting world, you were able to take control of that more quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of pick, whereas with music, it was sort of foisted upon you to a degree in the beginning. But then as time goes on, I'm sure that like, you were able to say, like, no, I don't want to do this song, or I want to start writing songs, or how did that process go?
That is a very keen observation. It is difficult, I think, with a record label where you are tied up for numerous album cycles. Whereas as an actor, it's like you have the free will to go, I don't want to work for a year, or I only want to do romantic comedy. So I felt I was able to like flex my creative muscle and choice like a lot more on that side of my life. So I think it helped me sort of lean into the fact that I didn't have as much control in the music side of my life for a good number of years. I think where it started to turn was when I was about 17, 18, I knew that kind of like the end of my shelf life on this particular record label was coming to an end. I think I had 3 records with them. And then I had taken like a good chunk of time to like make movies, and it was like a good year or so, and I hadn't really like done another record with them. And I could feel like there was some changes like at the label with like personnel and whatnot. So I felt like, you know what, I think to kind of add a punctuation to this relationship, I'm going to give them one last record like as part of my contract, but I want to do it on my terms. And I had just started, like as you would a senior in high school or a freshman in college, like started discovering all kinds of new music that I didn't know as a kid. So like Joe Jackson and XTC and Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon and Elton John, and I decided that I wanted to make a cover record, and because there was all this great music that I was like, this sounds like a hit song to me. I don't know why people my age wouldn't know about it and wouldn't be like shouting it from the rafters. So they let me make this crazy record called Coverage with like a John Hiatt song as the lead single. And like, and that was my sort of swan song with them, but it was also my way of like, it was the beginning of the next chapter of my music career, which was writing music. It was like I discovered all of these incredibly prolific songwriters that I fell in love with, and it's what ultimately inspired me to start wanting to write myself.
So you hadn't written at all at that point?
No, and I hadn't even really thought about it.
I was going to say, like, was it an option?
Definitely not an option. No. And then
how do you start?
I started with lyrics.
So you started with lyrics, like writing poetry, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Kind of just like free writing my thoughts and then trying to like find some way to shape them. I found it really helpful to co-write with people. So writing with somebody who had a grasp of like, you know, playing guitar or playing piano or something. And that's what I think like opened up the floodgates and opened up a world to me. And then I started seeing like poetry or seeing lyrics or seeing phrases sort of in like either when I was reading or like reading the newspaper or something that somebody would say would spark something. It was like once I formulated my thoughts to sort of like the antennas were up, it was a game changer.
Is it weird co-writing with someone? Because I feel like that's must be such an intimate process, and oftentimes with a stranger. I mean, you're kind of like being set up on a blind date, if I have it right.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you have to like...
It's always more comfortable with someone that you know or you're familiar with, and that's sort of how I started out. But sometimes it's great to, like, be vulnerable with someone who doesn't know you and doesn't know all your baggage and, like, comes at, like, you could be talking about a certain life situation and they have a completely different perspective or, like, bit of advice that you're like, wow, I never saw it that way. So it's – both sides of the coin are okay. I am an open book and I will talk to anybody about anything. So I've – like, I found it always, like, immediately so cathartic to write because it just helps you understand your life that much more, you know? Even if something doesn't come of it, it's just, like, just to be able to give, like, voice to certain thoughts or ideas, like, I find it so beneficial.
I've always said that I don't always know how I feel about something until I sit down to write about it or until I get on the phone with my best friend, who's been my best friend since I was 5. Like, it's this weird thing where it's like I don't know how I feel. I haven't necessarily processed it until I am either talking to Kelly or writing it down.
Yeah.
Have you had that? Is that?
I think, yeah, yes. I mean, I feel that way, like, with my friends. But I've found that with writing at certain junctures of my life. It's therapy. And it's free. And you can keep it insular. Like, I could go through my phone right now because I've been sort of writing in dribs and drabs for the last few years. And I can find lyrics of – and it's crazy because I can immediately transport myself back to
– that wormhole.
That wormhole and that frame of mind, like, where I was during that time. It's so evocative in that way. Yeah.
And also kind of crazy because it's like this emotional diary.
Yeah.
Of where you are, but you can also, because it's art, you can also say, like, no, that's not about that, if you want, which is also kind of amazing, right?
Yes,
absolutely. Like, no, it's just about the universal experience of having a cat, I swear.
Sure. Everyone goes through heartbreak. It's not about anyone specific.
No, no, it's universal heartbreak,
yeah.
Totally. So you're still writing?
I am.
Are you working on music still?
Not like currently, but the idea of it sort of just exists in the ether and it's up to me. And maybe this podcast will help sort of like just motivate me to get back to it. I live with an incredibly profound musician who like plays piano and guitar and we have music constantly streaming in the house all the time. And he's like, let's write together today. And I'm like, no, I have to go do this errand. Like I consciously like put it off. And I think I'm just scared to sort of open Pandora's box. And I need to get over that and get back to it because I miss – I'll go see him, like, perform. And I ache to be on stage. I ache to, like, sing.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And it's nice because I have a job and, you know, the show that I'm on, I get to sing, like, every now and then. And it, like, just, like – it touches something deep within me. It, like, just satiates me for another, like, couple of months or something. But I know that I am completely in control of whether or not that part of my life is ignited again. So I got to get back on it.
But I feel like it's one of those things, though, that it takes me a long time to write often because I'm thinking about it for so long. But then when I actually sit down and write, it's all there because I've been working through it in the shower and on my commute and like when I'm supposed to be sleeping. But the point is like when it's actually time to do it, then it's there. So maybe
– I feel like I'm in that spot. It's
maybe
there.
You're just circling.
I am.
And then
trying to find just the right cozy little nook to be like, all right.
And then that's the moment. Also, you've had a lot going on. I mean, the show is huge. Everyone in the entire world watches it. So my question is this. Do you find, like, do you bring stuff from music to acting and from acting to music?
I think that sense of fortitude, because in the music industry, it's like I only could rely on myself. I think I needed that fortitude to know that I could go it alone on during the lean times, because there have been many, many of those years, in fact, for me of, you know, going from having like this fun, bustling, thriving music career and like movies were happening to like everything slowing down to a screeching halt. So knowing that I was in control of making moves to sort of start things back up again and that I really, at the end of the day, really had to just lean on myself. You know, I try to bring that sense of awareness, I think, with me into like every aspect of what I do now.
How do you stay motivated when times are tough? Because I think all of us go through periods of that. And I think especially in the acting world, you have to be validated before you can practice your craft.
Yeah.
Like you have to be hired for the thing before you can do the thing.
Yeah.
And it's not in your control.
It is. It's so true. I have found that in order for me to find some semblance of control in those moments where things were not firing and I couldn't find a job and I just didn't know which end
You're
was
like the
up.
Pilot's not going.
Oh,
or
yeah,
the thing.
Three different pilots like for like 3 years didn't happen. 4 years actually didn't happen.
And P.S. for the people who aren't in the industry.
Yeah.
Like when your pilot doesn't
get picked up,
you've missed that pilot season and then you're not going to be on the air.
Yeah.
For a year. So then you have to wait.
So it takes you out of the game. Like every January through March or April, actors in Los Angeles descend upon every audition across town and you wait to see if you're going to get booked in a pilot and then it films and then the networks decide whether or not they're going to pick those up for like their fall or mid-season. So essentially, yeah, if something that you've poured your heart into and you're absolutely so creatively fulfilled by and you love the people you're working with, like when that ultimately doesn't happen, it is so defeating. And that form of rejection is so deeply personal that it's hard.
For a long time.
It's for a long time.
Pilot season is once a year.
Once a year.
Right?
So like
it's
when
not
that
like
doesn't
film.
No. Yeah. It's like once that doesn't happen, it's like you wait again until January through March for the next batch of TV shows to get written. So it's, I mean.
And to have three of those.
In a row. Actually, it was 3 years of having ones that I had set up specifically. The first year, I had helped come up with the concept and been at all the pitches and sold it. And that was great. And then it didn't happen. And it was the most, like, soul-crushing feeling. Then the next year, I did this other pilot. And it was, like, with this director who, like, every one of his pilots for the last, like, 20 years has gotten picked up. And then that didn't get picked up. And then the next year, I did this other one with Tracy Ullman. And it was, like, again, that one didn't get picked up. And then the next year, I remember I was, like, oh, I don't know if I can stomach this again. I remember I auditioned for something that I didn't even like. And I was like, but I'll do it because it's a job and I'm desperate and I just want to practice my craft. And I remember the feedback like came back and it was like, I didn't end up getting it. I was like, what? I didn't even get the thing I didn't want? That was when I seriously started evaluating like, I don't know if this is for me. I don't know if I can hack this. Maybe I need to move back to Florida. Maybe I need to go back to music. Maybe I need to go back to school. Like, in those moments, I decided that, A, it was okay to allow myself to feel my feelings and to be upset and to, you know, to feel rejected, to be disappointed. But then very quickly, I had to find a way to take control, and whether that was going back and writing music so I could feel somewhat in control of, like, my creative faculties, but also, like, taking class, like, doing everything I could to ensure that I was, like, keeping myself in gym shape in a sense. Like, not
doing
physically,
the work.
But doing the work so then I at least was exercising those muscles and I would feel some semblance of those creative juices flowing. But I was also keeping myself ready and limber and, like, waiting for when the moment did come. And it did. Like, just being patient and trusting, this is what I'm meant to do. This is who I am. This is who I've always been. There's no plan B. There's no other option for me. I'm not going back to Florida. I can always go back to music, but this is what I want. I want to be on a television show. I want to do something that is creatively fulfilling and is showing a different side of me that I don't think I've been able to do with some of my other work. And then lo and behold, 6 months later, This Is Us came around. And I auditioned for it and all of that and had to go through all of that rigmarole. It's not like somebody just handed it to me, but it just showed me, like, you have to be patient and have that belief in yourself and all the while, like, keeping yourself ready, because when this opportunity came, it was like, it wasn't during pilot season. It was off cycle, like, came during October, November. And then we ended up shooting it in January when most pilot season is just starting to ramp up. But because I think I was ready for it, my mind was open, my heart was open, it found me, and that was it. Everything is totally different this go-round.
Well, you appreciate it in a different way.
And you know the highs and lows. You know what it's like to, like, have those years of, like, that are really lean and starving, and you're like, I don't think I'm ever going to get another job. And so it really makes you present and appreciate the moment, and I feel more prepared. I feel like I approach my job differently. And obviously that's also just going to come with age and experience, but it definitely feels so different this go around. I'm aware of my surroundings so much more.
You were doing a lot of voice work.
I was.
For animated films and TV also at that same time.
Yep.
Do you like that?
I love it.
Okay, why do you like it? How is it different? And how did you get started doing it?
It's oddly, I think it was really helpful, the skill set of being a recording artist, knowing my voice, like being confident behind the microphone in that sense. I think all of those skills really lended themselves to me finding some semblance of success with voiceover work.
And in theory, you can do it in your pajamas,
You can do it in your pajamas. And I feel like it also employs like a part of your sort of childlike brain. You're able to use your imagination in a way that I don't feel I'm able to with any other aspect of my career or my life, because there's no point of reference. It's not like I did that movie, that Disney movie, Tangled. It's not like you're watching a screen in the booth. You're reading a script like you would a regular script, and you're going through those scenes by yourself. There's nobody to act with. And they end up choosing those performances, and then they animate to the performance. You're sitting there like reading and someone describing to you like, okay, now this giant waterfall is like chasing you guys and you're running through this tunnel. You really have to close your eyes and like picture this whole scene so you know where you are, and it still feels authentic and grounded even though it's a voiceover. It's like people want to feel every bit of emotion in your voice, so it's like you got to put yourself there. So it did. That was another great thing during those times that like really sustained me and fulfilled me, because I was able to like do what I love.
So you're having this huge moment right now, and now is a good time to reflect and think back. What advice would you give yourself in 1999?
Oh, what advice would I give? I would say be prepared for those leaner times, and embrace them and learn from them and appreciate them, because they are going to color and enrich all the other times. And I would also say I wish I had told my younger self, like, I wish that I had said yes to things more. And
like
I know
what?
That sounds weird, but I feel like I missed out on bits of my life because I was so focused on my career, which there's nothing wrong with it. But I just the little things of like we traveled to incredible places around the world. And I think it was like I was just this little like robot in a way. I would go to bed and I'd wake up and I'd work all day, and I'd go to bed and I'd wake up and I'd work all day.
You're a pro.
I was a pro, but I was also a kid, and now I travel to some of these places and it's like, wow, I've never been – no, I have been here before, but I never saw it. I didn't like take the time to say, you know what, I'm going to take the afternoon and go see a museum, or I'm going to go out to dinner with everybody and not order room service. Like I think that I was very – shy and okay to sort of let somebody else dictate my life. And I was very, again, happy and grateful to like be in those shoes and to have those opportunities. And I didn't want people to ever think that I was unappreciative or I was taking it for granted. So I think I sort of just did what I thought I was supposed to do. Whereas like as you get older and you realize like, no, I was always in control. Like I should have owned that more. I would probably tell my 19-year-old self that.
Okay, so what are you interested in doing next? What – I mean, obviously, you have the show.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's some music percolating.
Music's percolating.
You have some Garnier stuff going on.
Doing like, some spokesperson stuff.
Which is a cool opportunity.
It's so cool. Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? I would
What do
love
you want
to
do next?
I want to produce. I want to direct. And hopefully that will all sort of like happen, hopefully directing maybe the show if the show continues to go on. I hope like all, I think all, most of us in the cast like have ambitions to direct, and some of us have before.
What makes you want to do that?
I think because I've lived with this family and these stories and the situation, and I've having the benefit of being on this show now that we're about to start our third season, I feel like I know the machinery of what it takes to put together an episode. I'm not saying that I would necessarily make a great episode, but I – because, like, it's not a movie that you're working on for 3 months. Like, we live with these people for 7.5 months out of the year. I feel like it's the perfect training ground of, like, if I'm ever going to do it, this is the best place to start. It's the most comfortable. It's the most supportive.
You know what everyone does now.
I know what everybody does. Exactly. I'm like, I know what a gaffer is. I feel like, yeah, that maybe wouldn't have been an ambition of mine had I not gotten on a television show. But I want to produce like documentaries and maybe other TV shows or movies or something. Like, I think,
where does that come from?
Wanting to be in control of not finding material. Like, I have this hiatus from work right now. Everybody else in, like, the cast is off doing stuff right now. And I didn't find anything that moved me, that made me say, this is what I'm going to devote my time off to. This is worthy of, like, my energy, because I feel so fulfilled and satisfied with the job that I have. Like, creatively, I love that it touches people. It checks all the boxes. So to find another job that, like, that fulfills me in the same way, I couldn't. And I realized I have to do something about that. Like, I have to go out there and peruse articles and find books and, like, start adapting stuff and start, like, taking my life and my career in my own hands and, like, figuring out what's next, because no one's going to do it for you. I've learned that. Like, no one's ever going to do it for you. You're your own worst critic. You're your biggest advocate. So, like, if I want to get something done, it's going to fall on my shoulders.
I always say you have to be the CEO of your own career.
Yes, ma'am.
Because no one else cares about it the way that you do. No one else has invested
so
in
true.
It. And no one else is going to guide it. Like, it has to come from within.
Yep.
And it's okay to own it. I think as women, sometimes we have a hard time reconciling our ambitions or admitting them.
Yes.
It has been something that I have come to later in life, rather than just, like, wanting to have someone else approve me for something.
Yeah.
Realizing that, no, that has to come from within and you have to create it yourself. It's an interesting thing to come into.
I think
coming
I feel
into
the
your
same
own power.
Way. Yes, absolutely. At 34, I feel like I'm finally starting to own it.
I mean, that's still really young.
I guess in the scheme of things, but yeah, I feel like it dawned on me a little later than most people. But I think I have approached life in a similar fashion. Like, I'm very much like, I will acquiesce, like, power and control to, like, other people, and I want to be liked, and I want to be a people pleaser.
It's the people pleaser.
It's the people pleaser.
Plus the type A.
Yes, 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 yes.
It's like
very
both
much.
Of those things.
Yeah.
But
it's
I'm
a
really
weird dichotomy.
I'm really excited that you, everything that you're interested in now is really coming from a place of power.
Yeah.
And empowering yourself.
Yes.
And others.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
Thanks, lady.
That was singer, songwriter, and actress Mandy Moore. Thank you guys for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Mandy, head on over to mydomain.com. We have all kinds of interviews with all kinds of interesting women, I promise. As always, I'd love to know who you'd like to hear from on this show, so please send your requests to secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram @HillaryKerr. If you liked today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by mydomain.com.